fall. Baby, it's not mine. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it, come in no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make to have in the middle of it. Grass make to have in the middle. We are grass make to have in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Boy, we have a lot going on out there. There's so much. We had a recent attack in Syria there of a village right on the edge of Damascus. And it was reported between several hundreds and up to 1,300 people died as a result of this chemical attack. Of course, our government is taking the stance that, well, we're going to wait and see. But we drew a line about a year ago, and this line we drew was if Assad launches any chemical attacks whatsoever, then we're going to launch an attack, at least some kind of a NATO action into Syria. It just so happens that when we speak of Syria, we have to speak of the Middle East. And Wesley Clark, a number of years ago, stopped by the Pentagon, and he was interviewed on Democracy Now! And we're going to play that interview just a second and see what you think of that interview. And he says that there was a plan back then before they attacked Iraq to take down seven countries in the Middle East. So I'm going to let you listen to that in just a second.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq? Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you, but there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
Boy, wasn't that an interview to end all interviews? So there was this plan. First, he said, the first part of the interview there, you know, if you listen carefully, was that there was a plan to go to war with Iraq. And he said, he asked for a reason. They said, there's no reason. We're just going to go to war, you know. And it's pretty well concluded now and widely accepted that the George W. Bush administration concocted a bunch of reasons of no support, outright lies in some cases, of children being thrown, newborn infants being thrown on the hospital floor, and so forth. And these were all put-up jobs. And Curveball was up there making allegations. And other very nefarious types of characters were creating a reason to go to war. Also, Colin Powell got caught up in it, if you'll remember, when he made this passionate speech before the UN, and he was calling these trucks that they had out there as chemical warfare trucks, chemobiology trucks, and they were weather trucks. And much later, he was very embarrassed about that, and they started tracking down who did this and who put forward these talking papers and so forth, but nothing ever happens. Washington is so corrupt these days that no one is punished over anything. But what was very interesting about the takedown of these seven countries is that it seems to be, and it's very, very, you know what I mean, a very, very great amount of evidence that exists right now that they are proceeding with a plan. And Wesley Clark probably shouldn't have ever outed this plan. That was the second part of the interview on Democracy Now! But when he said these seven countries were going to be taken down, they're in the process of taking these countries down. It looks like to me that there's a balkanization occurring to balkanize the Middle East. They have the Shiites fighting against the Sunnis. And I think that is a very integral part of the overall plan, was to get these different factions that were at odds with each other over the decades, if not centuries, and to get those in a sectarian type of conflict. And by gosh, it did happen. There were earlier reports way back in 2011 in Syria that there was agent provocateurs that were firing at both sides to get this civil war, so-called civil war in Syria going. This recent attack in Syria only came 2 days after a fact-finding UN group arrived there. And even one of the members of the UN group said it's not very probable that Assad's government would have launched an attack 2 days after we got here. That just is not plausible. And what is not plausible is Assad would have to be insane to launch any chemical or even a biological or chemical or biological, either one, against any group while he's waging this war to hold on to that country. The Assads, the father, took out a whole village one time, a city, and just devastated it. And so the Assads have been known in the past to be ruthless. And we're not trying to defend the present Assad regime in Syria, because it's not absolutely outright, you know, lily white, so to speak. But for us not to report as accurately as possible on what's really going on there, I think it's absolutely necessary to do that. There was a report out of Northeast Intelligence that was claiming that the Benghazi station there, the consulate and the CIA annex that they've been talking about, was a way station of shipping arms into through Lebanon into the Syrian rebels. And people were contemplating back in October of last year, 2012, that these arms, especially the chemical arms, would be used to create a provocateur, an agent provocateur incident, which could bring, would be enough of a prelude, enough of reason, a strong enough reason to bring the NATO with the United States and France and especially GP, Great Britain, coming in with force. Now, that seemed to be the play right now, and they're trying to determine this and trying to determine that, but it's not likely that this would ever have been launched by the existing Syrian government of Assad's regime. It doesn't make sense. He would only create a tremendous problem for himself if he had launched such an attack. I'm going to give you a little bit of a couple of minutes, not quite 3 minutes, of Paula Broadwell. She spoke up at an alumni get-together out in Colorado, and here's what she said about the Benghazi attack. Right now, it's hard to separate out the Benghazi attack from what's going on in Syria, and that's especially with this alleged chemical attack by the Assad regime against certain people. It had to possibly be a nerve attack if the people died in their sleep. This is what some of the chemical warfare experts are telling us. We're going to go to that clip right now. This is Paula Broadwell speaking in Colorado back last fall.
Thanks for taking my question. General Petraeus, in his new role, has a very difficult situation now in the center of the situation in Benghazi. Do you have any comment?
Well, just to create some context for those in the room, as you know, the ambassador in Benghazi was killed along with a couple of security agents who happened to be CIA security paramilitary forces. That just came out today in Fox News. But the challenge has been the fog of war. And the greater challenge is that it's political hunting season, and so this whole thing has been turned into a very political sort of arena, if you will. But the facts that came out today were that the ground forces there at the CIA annex, which is different from the consulate, were requesting reinforcements. They were requesting it's called the Sinks in Extremist Force, a group of Delta Force operators, are very most talented guys we have in the military. They could have come and reinforced the consulate and the CIA annex that were under attack. Now, I don't know if a lot of you heard this, but the CIA annex had actually had taken a couple of Libyan militia members prisoner, and they think that the attack on the consulate was an effort to try to get these prisoners back. So that's still being vetted. The challenging thing for General Petraeus is that in his new position, he's not allowed to communicate with the press. So he's known all of this. They had correspondence with the CIA station chief in Libya. Within 24 hours, they kind of knew what was happening. But if you remember at the time, the Muslim video, the Muhammad video that came out, the demonstrations that were going on in Cairo, there were demonstrations in 22 other countries around the world, tens of thousands of people. And our government was very concerned that this was going to become a nightmare for us. So you can understand if you put yourself in his shoes or Secretary Clinton's shoes or the president's shoes that we thought it was tied somehow to the demonstrations in Cairo. And it's true that we have signal intelligence that shows the militia members in Libya were watching the demonstration in Cairo, and it did sort of galvanize their effort. So we'll find out the facts soon enough. As a former intel officer, it's frustrating to me because it reveals our sources and methods. I don't think the public necessarily needs to know all of that. It is a tragedy that we lost an ambassador and two other government officials, and something. There was a failure in the system because there was additional security requested. But it's frustrating to see the sort of political aspect of what's going on with this whole investigation. So the most recent news that came out was a Fox report by Jennifer Griffin. I got it on a distribution list I'm on, and it has some pretty insightful stuff in it, if you want to look for it.
The last question that was asked by an attendee there of that conference or that alumni get-together really was riveting. Her reply was riveting, and she was stating that, yes, there was a CIA annex there, and they had kidnapped or were holding some hostages of a local group, a jihadist group, and that could have been one of the reasons for the attack that did occur there in Benghazi. We think now from all available information that what happened was that the Benghazi attack was launched against the American annex, and the so-called consulate there for the reason that it was discovered that they were funneling weapon systems that had formerly been in the hands of the Libyan government. They were funneling those over to the Turks, could have possibly been helping ship those into Lebanon and in and through eastern Turkey into some of the northern areas there of Syria, so they could set up. There was an attack that was reported a way back, and now that's what the UN inspection group and fact-finding group was sent in to ascertain, was that this previous group, this group that's in there now, the UN group, that arrived 2 days before this recent incident, they went in there to investigate and inspect the evidence there about a previous chemical attack that had occurred in Syria that, again, the Assad regime was alleged to have carried out. So this most recent attack occurred 2 days after they went in there. So that's very important to consider. And since Broadwell was intimately involved with General Petraeus, then she was getting some very, very advanced information. And she probably shouldn't have said anything at that time about this attack or any of the details at the time that she spoke to this group out there. So, as a result, we did get some insight from that on that about the Benghazi attack. And there's other news out there. I mean, it's fantastic statements made by our president that it's apologetic. It's like, no, nobody ever did anything wrong on this NSA stuff. And if there was anything there, it was all inadvertent. It wasn't real. It was. It shouldn't have been. They made a few mistakes, but actually, there's nothing to that, and they can't really be held responsible because it was just accidents that they picked up your email, right? Sure, it was just accidents that these things happened. The NSA originally, when they were chartered, had the responsibility of developing and intercepting and collecting information and signal intelligence and communications intelligence outside of the United States. They never, back in 47, soon after that, they never had the responsibility or the mission of collecting information and intelligence within this country. What has happened is that our intelligence agencies, along with the police departments and our military had been schooled, and they've been schooled in such a way as to create the idea that they could create a network, and that would give us a lot more security. See, and in this more security area, then we could be much better protected. But what we had to do in arriving at a higher security level is we had to learn more about all the Americans, because by gosh, we could actually prevent, we might be able to create a preventive type of mechanism, and that's where they're headed now. This is dangerous. This is very, very dangerous territory that we are embarking on, is preventive crime. Are you kidding me? Back about a year or two ago, there was some science that came out. There's some kind of report out of the UK or Germany. I think there was a report out of Germany that they were able to actually read people's minds and maybe possibly prevent a crime from happening. You know, are you kidding? This is real today, and we're under a major threat. The major threat that America is under is not by the jihadist or al-Qaeda or any of these terrorist groups. What has been built and being structured is a tremendously repressive national security state. And in that national security state, we're going to have less freedoms, less ability to move around, less liberties, and so forth. This is a real, real deal. And we get awful frustrated here, and Charlotte feels the same way at times, where we see the public out there trying to grasp and get hold of exactly what's going on, but the media is still there and it's still very influential. It's not having quite the impact that it used to have. Like these recent programs on MSNBC and so forth, and one was recently in there just, oh boy, they went after, Alex Jones. This little Alex Wagner, you know what I mean? And they structured that. They had this guy from the Southern Poverty Law Center there. And they just harped on, it got back to those bombers up there in Boston, you know. No one's been convicted yet, so that an alleged bomber is in court and under indictment, who's done indictment, is in court now, or shortly. But there is no conviction yet. But they just start using the word Boston bombers. You know, that's it, you know. There's evidence there on the ground that there were acting groups there. There's evidence that they were running a drill there, and so forth. And so to claim just absolutely that the Boston bombers are there and convicted, and one is dead, one died, and one survived. And then they made all kinds of claims or released lies. They lied about, oh, his throat was cut, so he can't talk. But that was never the case, see. They even came up with something that he wrote something on the inside of this and that. And they, you know, I mean, we are facing the most dangerous period that this country has ever been through, that is beginning to, you know, go through. The period that we're in is much like the Weimar Republic, which was just preceded the Nazi regime. We have so much information now out that's come out that many of the Nazis escaped out of Germany and were allowed to escape. And the Catholic Church was running rat lines to affect their transportation and shelter. They sheltered them in monasteries and so forth, churches, and provided a mechanism to help them escape out of Germany. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about my whole concept and idea has changed over the years. I used to accept these labels and these different compartmentalizations of different dynamics and different people and entities and institutions. And then I began to wake up and I was beginning to see, well, you know, you've got a fascist mentality within the German group, but then also you have some British that are British fascist, and you got American fascist. It's a whole mentality is what has developed of fascism. So it's across the board. It's just not one place or one country. But then you might call them, phalangist in Spain. Oh, yeah, there was the Spanish experience, too. And so they go down there and pick up Franco, that's a colonel over there, and they elevate him to general or whatever. And then they send him into Spain to take back their land. The Republic had confiscated the Catholics' property, so the Catholic Church went down there and brought a fascist in and put him in power. Yeah, that's what your church did, see. So people that are members of these big churches and big institutions, I would just drop out, you know. I wouldn't continue to be a member of any church that did anything like that. Why support an ongoing system of power and money and control? You vote with your money. You vote with your ideas and your time. And I told someone just recently, we started talking about Breaking Bad, you know. And so I had a conversation with a 16-year-old and her mother, and we were you know, talking about what is Breaking Bad about. And so I have not seen any of the episodes, and I really need to see some of the episodes. But the premise, the original premise of the TV series, and I think they're in their fifth, year of it or whatever. season, I guess is the word they use in television. Yeah, they're in their fifth season, I think the fifth and final in Good Riddance, you know, is what I'd say. The premise of the story is wrong to start with. Now, I know what the premise is. It's about that a man is going to go out and learn how to cook methamphetamine so that he can get together some money, and then that money that he gets together will be, he has terminal cancer is what the way the story goes. And so he's going to get together this money and then make a bunch of money by cooking meth and then selling it, helping distribute it, I guess, and then turn a bunch of this money, make a lot of money, and then turn that money over to his family before he dies. I mean, what a sick idea. Are you kidding me? So I go around and I ask people, what do you think about that? And I say, well, taking drugs is, that's your own choice, you know. The attitude out there is flippant. It supports drug use. It doesn't say, back in the 60s when I was growing up, drug use was looked down on and was frowned on. And we thought it was a very despicable thing to do. So we never supported it openly. But today, this mentality of, do your own thing, and it's up to them. It's their choice, you know. The question should be, do you support and vote with your time and money or whatever a program? I know they're saying that, oh, it's beautiful drama, and it's got all of these different awards and stuff like that. Okay, a broken, debased society is giving a program like Breaking Bad awards. Now, what kind of awards are those? Are they worth anything, an award like that, or not? If you have a society that is a viable, strong society, okay, and they give someone awards, that might be something to take note of. But on the other hand, if you have a society out here, okay, that is out and doing things that would be considered being debased. I mean, we've got people sleeping around with other people. Adultery, that doesn't mean anything anymore to a lot of people. To church people, it should, because that's one of the Ten Commandments. And, you know, I believe that you shouldn't be going around doing things like that. You're breaking up marriages that were sanctioned, so-called, under God, with God's, under God's approval, so to speak. And two people that are bonded together in marriage, you start messing around with that bond, and you're going to break up families, and you're going to cause a lot of hardship in a lot of ways. So I just don't believe that this new society that we live in, that's very, very loose, very loose morals, and so forth, I just don't think that is the way to live, period. And it doesn't matter if you're an atheist, agnostic, or Bible-thumping fanatic. To mess around with someone's wife is messing around with someone's wife. Might be an atheist friend or something like that. It doesn't matter. You're going to create problems. A lot of hurt and pain. And you're going to break up families also. So it is just not the thing to do, period. And it's not good for anyone. But here I am on a, you know, sermonette, or I guess if you call it. I just don't go along with many of these avant-garde types of ideas that are being pushed on us, that I don't feel they're any good at all, and they're not good for our society. Well, let's get back to this chemical attack. Get back and see. We had a big conviction of Hassan out there in Fort Hood. Is that what is coming in the news right now? He was convicted. Going in there and just, you know, popping people. You know, he faces the death penalty, you know. So here we've got a psychiatrist, okay, who goes out and does such a thing. I mean, it's just, you know what I mean? a convicted Major Nadal Hassan to the deadly 2009 shooting rampage at Fort Hood, making the Army psychiatrist eligible for the death penalty in the shocking assault against American troops by one of their own on home soil. How does such a thing occur, you know, in this country? I mean, when I say a debased society, I think that's proof of it right there, folks. Now you can say, okay, he wasn't, you know, Islamic and, you know what I mean, believer of Islam and so forth, and he hated America and this and this and that and so forth. So you could use that as an excuse to diss this, to go against him. Here's another bit of news from the Guardian over in Mario, England, and they're saying that the NSA had financial relationships with certain companies. And just a recent release, the National Security Agency paid millions of dollars to cover the cost of major internet companies involved in the PRISM surveillance program. After a court ruled that some of the agency's activities were unconstitutional, according to top secret material passed to The Guardian, the technology companies, which the NSA says included Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and Facebook, incurred the cost to meet new certification demands in the wake of the ruling from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. That's a secret court. We don't need any secret courts, but that is a secret court. The October 2011 judgment, which was declassified on Wednesday by the Obama administration, found that the NSA's inability to separate purely domestic communications from foreign traffic violated the Fourth Amendment. While the ruling did not concern the PRISM program directly, documents passed to The Guardian by whistleblower Edward Snowden described the problems that the decision created for the agency and the efforts required to bring operations into compliance. The material provides the first evidence of a financial relationship between the tech companies and the NSA. Well, this tells us that the government is intricately involved with these companies and providing them millions, if not into the billions of dollars. We don't even know what they have. The FISA court. I mean, do we need these secret courts? I don't think we do. I think the mechanism of national security has been a gimmick to circumvent, to hide behind the veil of national security, special operations that, like in this case, they're saying those evidently, those were unconstitutional programs that even the FISA court, which is a secret court, was forcing them to come into compliance. Now, Why didn't we know it right then? We didn't know it right then because it's a FISA secret court. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, FISA, is a United States law which prescribes procedures for the physical and electronic surveillance and collection of foreign intelligence information between foreign powers and agents of foreign powers, which may include American citizens and permanent residents suspected of espionage or terrorism. The law does not apply outside the United States. The law has been repeatedly amended since the September 11th attacks. Well, were the September 11th attacks, they always get back to that. They'll use that as a reason and a cause to go ahead and give credence and to give apologetic types of approaches to any of these. Oh, we're going to apologize. But look, we got the September 11th attacks. We just had to do this. This is reason to skate over anything, any objection to any of their activities, where it's NSA or anything else. It's a big cover-up behind this national security screen. There was a documentary done a while back called Secrets, and I would highly recommend you going out and getting that. We'll have a place that you can go to that and secure that documentary called Secrets. And it has to do with the government expanding their and the increase, the expansion, and the increase of government declaring and classifying more and more activities and documents and so forth as secret, top secret, and so forth. So the answer to this, what government says, let's just create 800 under the, top secret program that they created a number of years ago. Let's just create 850,000 top secret America with the program put out by Priestley and them. You know, let's just go ahead and create 850,000 more top secret clearances, and we'll give those to a bunch of civilians out there. People that don't even, aren't even in the military, not connected to the government. Oh, what we'll do is we'll create a bunch of these mechanisms and companies that can spy on you. So there'll be databases here and databases there. They'll all have top secret clearances. And with those top secret clearances, then they can go out here and they can gather information. Yeah, they're going to gather information on good American citizens, the good loyal ones that want to fight this corrupt government. And then the corrupt government will go after those good, loyal American citizens that are against that corrupt government, and the corrupt government will use that information against these good, loyal American citizens. That's what we're beginning to see. We're beginning to see a tremendous amount of information and data and that's going to be used politically. Don't for once believe what Obama or any of these other top dogs say about, well, we're just doing this for our security. We've got these jihadists out here. Yeah, there was jihadists all over Oklahoma City area. There was one local resident that wrote an excellent article on InfoWars about this. There were just too many people in the Oklahoma City. Go up there and look into that. There's too many people in Oklahoma City area, too much going on. The Murrah building came down. There was too much. So the American people are going to be surveilled more unless they really get their gander up and go after these government people. You've got to start lobbying. You've got to become active. No, let's go out and look at sports. Oh, baseball is the thing to do now. Now let's go out and do some golfing. That's what we should do. And then we can talk about how we shot that approach shot there and all this stuff. Stuff that doesn't even make a bit of difference. While at the same time, the big boys, the big dogs, are coming. And they're coming after us, the good people. And they won't, because we're against the banks. We're against the banksters. We're against the Federal Reserve System and all that. In their pocket, not in yours. So, What I suggest on these bank charges is that we need some state legislatures to look into this. And if we have any state legislatures, look in there. I'm going to talk to David Simpson, some of these people. We're going to try to get a law put in there and prohibit that. I don't think they can legally do it right now, but we need to stop these bank charges. They're going too far. There's you go into a bank and you say you're not going to pay those, and then three or four or five different tellers and bank managers will come around and, oh, you got to pay that and this and that, and, you know, that we have a right, you know. They don't have a right to charge that at all, I don't think. And what we need to do is make sure through state legislation and state laws to stop them from charging that $7 or whatever it is. It's not right. You should have never been allowed. And we need to go after those bank charges and do away with them. The mentality here is what is surprising. See, that's what we're looking at out here, is that we're looking at a bunch of people working for big corporations, and some of these banks out there, like Wells Fargo and Wachovia, they've been caught laundering hundreds into the billions of dollars of drug money. And so we're going to go into these banks and pay them a $7 fee for cashing a check that's good, and we're going to give them additional money. Are you kidding me? We're not going to do that. Go look up that Wells Fargo and Wachovia deal way back. Yeah, when Wells Fargo bought out Wachovia. There were dirty banking deals out of Mexico on that deal. So these banks are not clean at all, and we need to put our foot down on this, these bank charges. Well, anyway, getting back to our mentality thing, I know I talk about men, and I talk about men and their ego state and things like that. Well, they do have an ego problem. And I had an ego problem for a long time. And in my late 30s, early 40s, about 41, 42, I began to wake up. And I began to say, oh my gosh, I don't like what I see. And what I saw was a very arrogant, egotistical person. I'm talking about myself now. So you men out there that criticize me talking about the male ego, let me tell you about my male ego, you know. Well, I had one, and I didn't like, after I woke up and began to see myself objectively, so to speak, I didn't like what I saw, and I began to understand about men and the state that they exist in. And that state can be described as a very remote, detached state from and separated out from the life-giving and nurturing of which women are basic to their innate and being. Their very being cries out to give life and nurture life. Women do. Men can easily be persuaded and influenced to kill. The ego state in men is much stronger. And it gives way to a Godhead, to they are God, men are gods. We have today, when we're talking about, when Charlotte and I have been talking over the years about psychopaths and sociopaths and so forth, they're right at the top of all of these government and military and police organizations, and intelligence especially. You find some of the worst psychopaths in the intelligence agencies and in these very deep black ops types of operations. This country is being dominated by a bunch of insane people. That is the real core problem that we have to put up with. And they describe themselves, they hide themselves rather well. That's why it's difficult to get to the exact, to get to the truth about the way the government is organized and so forth. These people have no morals. They're ruthless. They have no conscience. In fact, the people that we've interviewed over the years that are experts, on psychopathic behavior and so forth, says one of the main characteristics of a psychopath is there is no conscience. They have no conscience. Thus, to them, good and evil, it doesn't matter. Because they're not bothered, you know, by their actions and by what they do to anyone. But there is a mechanism there of male ego, which is elevation of themselves. That what you have to be able to see is that we're not able to stand outside ourselves and look back at ourselves that well. We're involved inside, and the conversation that we have and the concept of who we think we are occurs within the mind. So we're not very often able to stand outside and look back and say, oh my gosh, George, what in the hell did you do that for? You know? But with a little age, a young person is not going to get there with this. But I am speaking to young people too, though, because there are some sharp people out there that can hopefully begin to understand what I'm talking about here. Many men just reject out of hand, period, instantly, immediately what I'm saying. Oh, he's full of it. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's crazy, you know. This and that. Men are the sharp people. Oh, yeah, you got people out here. They just, you know, trumpet the glory of men and what they're capable of doing and so forth. And but they're not helping overcome what I call the man problem. And the man problem is real simple. It's that we have a glorification of self through an imagined and a conjured up type of mechanism. That is what actually is really going on. And in that state of who we think we are, it's pleasing to us. So we become these great adventurers, these great heroes, these great villains in some cases, these very powerful figures, see. And that's proceeding towards some godlike image of who we think we are. Women, on the other hand, are tied back to the family and life and birthing and things like that. Their physical makeup is their destiny on both sides. So we have to be careful when we talk about this subject. But especially men, they're going to reject what I'm saying. And the reason why they're rejecting what I'm saying is very simple. The false self of which they have come to believe is their self, their real self, okay, is a conjured up, in many cases, much more abstract than it is real. And in this abstracted, unreal state, this state of glorification of self, then they are accepting and find this very pleasing, these ideas that are very amusing to themselves. If you can imagine these senators in Rome walking around in these robes and strutting around in the Senate, you know, in these robes and thinking themselves as great, you know what I mean, scions of you know what I mean, their society and the great men and the great speakers and so forth. If you can take that and look at our Congress, you'll find all these little puffed up toads and frogs, you know, the same way. They strut and they're powerful and they've got power and they've got this. Yeah, they've got power and they got this, but it's fleeting. It's temporal. It's not lasting. And it is the downfall of themselves and their society. And right now, this 9/11 is being used in that manner to create a mechanism to bring this country down. So we have to get back to 9/11. And hopefully try to look at the evidence that exists and try to see if it was a legitimate attack on this country or not. Myself, I do not think it was a legitimate attack, foreign attack. I think it was concocted within the country by some of our top intelligence agencies and individuals. And I think it was to take down the country and to control the country and to put it under a much more authoritarian type of rule. I believe that those people at the top of this so-called pyramid are aware that that the American public is beginning to wake up about their money system. And this Federal Reserve, of which all these banks are members of, including Wells Fargo and all those, are creating credits on a set of books. And then loaning that money to us. And so they're creating money from out of thin air and charging us for interest for something that was created that was not worked for. We must stand up against these banks. And we must begin to try to understand what these banks are really about. The average person out here in America still is caught up and mesmerized by the system of getting caught up in activities. These activities take our attention away. A friend of mine was brought up this rodeo clown recently, see? And, you know, that's a good analogy in a way, is that the rodeo clown goes out and gets the bull's attention after the cowboy has been bucked off. And then once he's got the attention of the bull, then he leads that bull away, see? Okay? So away from the cowboy. And actually the bull is focused on the clown, the cowboy clown, instead of the cowboy. And the cowboy can scamper off, can, you know, hustle out of there and hopefully keep from being stomped on or killed. So it's like that today you have people that are trying to obfuscate the truth. They're trying to divert our attention away from the important issues of the day and trying to keep us focused on nonsensical or not really important things, but less important things, while they'll take and make money and fortunes by those things that they, those mechanisms, like what they've done through all these wars, they have stolen, these business people have stolen hundreds of millions into the billions from American public, probably into the trillions of dollars if you want to count it. But there's no way of getting a legitimate, honest accounting of these monies. So they have actually pirated the ship. The good ship called America has been cornered. It has been boarded at sea, so to speak. The pirates have clambered on board ship. They've taken over the ship and they've set the sails, and they've killed all the good people on board or thrown them overboard. And then they are charting a new course for a new to back to their pirate den, see, back to where their cohorts are, so they can take the booty, divide it up, and then go out and buy new ships or you know, arm new ships, and then go out and do it all over again, see. So it's one, you know, type of robbery by, you know, pirating after another. The country of Egypt for a long time has been dominated by the armed forces. And the armed forces have not only been receiving over $1 billion a year from the United States for military aid, but they've been dominating the economy. So the two things together have resulted in a tremendous wealth generated into their hands. Now, Morsi over there in November of last year was issuing presidential decrees, and these presidential decrees did not bode well for some of his own people. So, as a result, they turned against them also. But the people in the streets were turned out by the military. The military has a monopoly of force in that country, and they're not going to easily give that monopoly of force back to anyone or make it come under the authority of some kind of civilian president. They're in control. They have a monopoly of force. They own between 20 and 35% of the economy. They're not going to relinquish that interest and that money and control. And as a result, we're not going to see really much change occur in Egypt. If anything, this recent attack on the Muslim Brotherhood demonstrations was an absolute mistake on the part of the armed forces, the army. And they should have never moved against the crowds, and they should have never killed the number that they ended up killing. It's in the hundreds and maybe into the thousands. And as a result, the Muslim Brotherhood is not going to stop. There's just been too much blood spilled. And as a result, the armed forces are going to incur the wrath of the Muslim Brotherhood. Listen to this Russia Today quote and interview very carefully. Thank you.
The U.S. says the alleged chemical attack in Syria would be outrageous and a flagrant escalation by Assad if these reports are confirmed. There's still no evidence of the government's involvement in the attack or any confirmation about the number of victims. The pressure on the Syrian government is growing. Well, let's get the details now from RT's Marina Portnaya. So, Marina, we've been hearing demands for a thorough investigation into the attack from different sides now. So what are the allegations then from the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. is saying a variety of different things. During a press briefing Thursday afternoon, U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said that the U.S. has been unable to conclusively determine chemical weapon use and that Washington is working urgently to gather that information. However, in the same breath, Psaki also said that there's no possible way that the Syrian rebels, who Washington supports, could have been behind the latest round of alleged chemical weapon use. Take a listen.
We still believe that they don't have the capability to use chemical weapons. That has not changed. Again, we're looking into the facts on the ground, but there's no reason, if there's nothing to hide, for the regime not to let the investigative team.
Do you know if the UN team is operating under that those same assumptions, that the opposition doesn't have the ability to use these kinds of weapons?
Yes.
They are.
Mm-hmm.
So, Marina, where do those assumptions that the rebels can't be blamed for the attacks, where are those assumptions coming from?
I'm not sure where those assumptions are coming from, because so far we have not heard any UN official make any statements to support what Ms. Psaki just said during her press briefing. The precise reason a team of UN investigators are in Damascus at the moment is to investigate claims surrounding the alleged use of chemical weapons and who would be responsible for administrating those weapons. As a matter of fact, back in May, Carla Del Ponte, she's the lead investigator of the UN's Independent Commission of Inquiry on Syria, she said her team found evidence that rebel fighters are the ones that may have used the nerve agent sarin in Syria, and that it was not used by the Syrian government.
Our investigators have been in Syria and in neighboring countries, interview victims, doctors, and field hospitals. And in the latest report we got last week, I saw that although there is still no incontrovertible proof, there are very strong suspicions, judging by the kind of medical help the victims received, that sarin gas has been used by the opposition, rebels, and not the country's authorities. But it's not surprising, because militants and people from outside have already infiltrated the opposition.
And, of course, that was Mrs. Del Ponte from May. We don't know how much worse the situation may have gotten in Syria. Now, as of today, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said that Russia wants a fair investigation and has denied reports that Moscow blocked any type of UN Security Council statement on Wednesday when the council gathered together to discuss the alleged use of chemical weapons in Syria. In the meantime, France is reportedly urging a, quote, reaction of force, unquote, if reports of mass chemical attacks near Damascus are confirmed. Moscow says it's the United Nations that decides on the use of force, and so far no country can confirm any reports about the attack victims of any chemical weapon use. So there's a lot of sides to this circumstance, as we've been reporting, and a lot of investigations that are still ongoing.
Marina, thanks very much indeed for that. That's our reporter, Marina Portnoy, live there in New York.
We want to thank you, our listening audience there, for listening. We're going to come back and cover some more news and so forth. But thank you very much for listening, and we certainly enjoy our conversations on Saturday night with you. We're going to be interviewing in the future a book on the Dulles Brothers. We've got more on the derivatives out of Australia. We have an expert there that we're going to call in, and we have other guests lined up. Going to talk more about the secrets, too, how many secrets there are in the country, and what that protecting all the secrets is all about. Is it truly protecting America and Americans, or is it protecting inner elitist group and to hide their actions from the public? Well, I believe it's to protect that inner elitist group to hide their actions from the public. So anyway, we want to thank you again for listening. And good night if those are leaving us. Just hang in there with us. We'll be back in just about 3 or 4 minute break at the top of the hour. Thank you very much for listening.